Well, thank you to Mac and to Jeff, who have been doing the running in the background, and the invitation to come and speak to you. It's a great pleasure indeed. I was asked to speak about, can a scientist take Christianity seriously? And it's an area that is of great interest to me because I'm both a scientist and a Christian. And so what I want to do is defend this morning that you can be both a scientist and a Christian, which is something that many people don't believe is actually possible. First of all, a little bit about myself. The slide is very full of different bits and pieces that I like doing. I'm a theoretical physicist who has found himself in the astronomy community, in astrophysics. I'm interested in practical things as well. I am interested in electronics. I built a lot of equipment. I've designed and built computing systems. I've done that. I've written all the software for it. I started life coming from Holland and being here. I was always interested in rockets. And so I started life by thinking about rockets and thinking about going into rocket research. That actually never happened, but it was fun to think about rockets. I used to design my own rockets, and I actually made some rockets as well, just for the fun of it. I've also been interested in... I became a Christian when I was 18 at Sydney University. When I was going there, when someone said to me, "Have you ever read the Bible?" And I thought, oh, that's an interesting idea. An educated man should also know something about the Bible, surely. And because of that, I ended up a Christian, that is someone who's a follower of Jesus, at the same time as going further into my science, into my physics. I only want to be two things in life. At 11, I stopped playing. I know that sounds awful, but I actually remember the day I stopped playing and gave my toys away to my brothers. And I decided I either wanted to be a pilot or a physicist. And I won a scholarship to go to university, and therefore I became a physicist. I have a real hankering, however, every time I see a 747 take off, I have a real hankering to have been a captain, which I would easily have been, because in those days I would have been able to get into Qantas quite easily because of my maths and physics were very good. So... but anyway, I ended up being a physicist, and now I just fly planes on computers, which is fun. And safe, as I already pointed out to you. In the early 1980s, I had read a lot of Francis Schaeffer, and I was very interested in... Here was a man who was a Christian, but who understood culture, who understood how things, the flow of history, who understood a whole lot of things, and I thought, this is definitely something I want to be involved with. And I wrote to him, and I said to him, if you come to Australia, I'll carry your bags for you. Well, he never did come to Australia because he was ill. I didn't know that at the time. But cut a long story short, I met him, and from those early days, right through until now, I've been involved with working in a ministry which he set up called La Brie Fellowship. It's a ministry where we invite people to come and to have hospitality and to work through many questions, honest questions, and receive honest answers from a Christian perspective. So that's a little bit about myself. See that hopefully this thing is working. Yep. All right. Now, many of you know that science has often been appropriated by the atheist community to argue, in fact, that science is consistent with modern atheism, and that to be a scientist is not to have any kind of belief in any sort of God at all. However, as you well know, as you study the universe, science raises many questions about why is the universe this particular way? And so it asks questions like, why does the universe have the form that it does, for instance? The laws, the structure, the function, the principles, the information. These are real questions that arise out of scientific research. I mean, you can just do scientific research and just get answers to the measurements and fitting things together. You can do that, that's true. But at the end of it, at the backstop of all of that, are the why questions. And so often people don't go to the next level, which is, well, why is the universe like that? Why can science be done at all, in fact? And the only reason science can be done is because there are rules and there are form and there is information to be had and to be understood. It's such a simple question, but it's an important question, which many people seem to not want to ask anymore, and that seems silly, because that is something that's important to all of us. And so there are other questions like, we see a universe which seems to have slowly changed and developed and we have arisen out of that in terms of self-conscious life. And the other thing that really interesting is, why is the universe so fine-tuned? When you start doing the physics, when you do the theoretical physics, it turns out that you can make universes with a pencil and paper and design mathematically a universe, and you discover, in fact, as Stephen Hawking did back in the early 70s, you discover, in fact, that the universe that we have is very finely tuned, and that the constants, the physical constants, can have very, very limited values in order for the universe to exist in which we can exist. There are many possible universes, but the one in which we exist seems very difficult to make. The answers to the why questions are, in fact, beyond science, that is true, and the Jewish Christian worldview offers answers which resonate with the very questions that I think science raises and that I've had the privilege over many years to be involved in. They resonate with the answers to those why questions that make sense of doing the science that one does. Atheism offers no answers, in fact. All that atheism is good at is knocking. It knocks everything that you stand for. No one has ever improved their marriage because of atheism. No one has ever improved alcoholism because of their atheism. All it does is knock answers to say, well, we have the truth, but what is left is actually despair. And I just want to show you this clip for a second. This is Lawrence Krauss. He's an atheist. He was part of the Australian National University. He's an American. And he says this: atheism, we are actually insignificant, but smile anyway.
This tells us that we are more insignificant than we ever imagined. If you take the universe, everything we see, stars and galaxies and clusters, everything we see, if you get rid of it, the universe is essentially the same. We constitute a 1% bit of pollution in a universe that's 30% dark matter and 70% dark energy. We are completely irrelevant. Why such a universe in which we're so irrelevant would be made for us is beyond me. Okay, good. I wanted a little bit of applause. Now we can go back to the science.
Okay, if that is actually true, why isn't he crying? Why isn't he in despair? The truth is that if we really are insignificant, and it's a possible answer, not an answer that I agree with, but many people would agree with that. The average population out there are not thinking about these things, but if we really are irrelevant, then why aren't we in despair? Because we feel that we have significance and value. We want these things to be fully human. These are realities that are there to be human. And so that position is an interesting position, but one that doesn't cause me any kind of smile. And I think there's a certain dishonesty to say, well, I just want a little bit of applause for that. And he was speaking to a university audience, what's more, and people were laughing. It's not funny at all, if that's true. Now, it's not true that serious academics are all atheists, and although the writing is small, many people, including Nobel Prize winners, have had faith that there is a God and that that is all worthwhile. It's not true to say that all science, or because you're a scientist, you automatically don't believe that a God exists. In fact, surveys have been done, and amongst normal science people like myself, it turns out that it's the same proportion of people as in the community who have faith in God versus those who don't have faith in God. You sometimes get the feeling when you watch television that all scientists are atheists. This is just not true. The most vocal ones may well be, but it's not true when you actually go into academia. You find that people are in the same proportion believers and unbelievers as we have in the community. So that's an important thing to remember, because sometimes you get the feeling that atheism is automatically part of being science. It's not true. Belief in God exists because the existence of this universe is too good to be true. Now, I don't have the time to spend lots of time unpacking this, but I'm going to show you this clip because it explains it better than I can quickly.
From galaxies and stars, down to atoms and subatomic particles, the very structure of our universe is determined by these numbers. These are the fundamental constants and quantities of the universe. Scientists have come to the shocking realization that each of these numbers has been carefully dialed to an astonishingly precise value, a value that falls within an exceedingly narrow, life-permitting range. If any one of these numbers were altered by even a hair's breadth, no physical, interactive life of any kind could exist anywhere. There'd be no stars, no life, no planets, no chemistry. Consider gravity, for example. The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant. If this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, none of us would exist. To understand how exceedingly narrow this life-permitting range is, imagine a dial divided into 10 to the 60th increments. To get a handle on how many tiny points on the dial this is, compare it to the number of cells in your body, or the number of seconds that have ticked by since time began. If the gravitational constant had been out of tune by just one of these infinitesimally small increments, the universe would either have expanded and thinned out so rapidly that no stars could form and life couldn't exist, or it would have collapsed back on itself with the same result: no stars, no planets, and no life. Or consider the expansion rate of the universe. This is driven by the cosmological constant. A change in its value by a mere 1 part in 10 to the 120th parts would cause the universe to expand too rapidly or too slowly. In either case, the universe would again be life prohibiting. Or another example of fine tuning: if the mass and energy of the early universe were not evenly distributed to an incomprehensible precision of 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd, the universe would be hostile to life of any kind. The fact is, our universe permits physical, interactive life only because these, and many other numbers, have been independently and exquisitely balanced on a razor's edge. Wherever physicists look, they see examples of fine-tuning. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. If anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features that the universe has, he's hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. What is the best explanation for this astounding phenomenon? There are three live options. The fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Which of these options is the most plausible? According to this alternative, the universe must be life-permitting. The precise values of these constants and quantities could not be otherwise. But is this plausible? Is a life-prohibiting universe impossible? Far from it. It's not only possible, it's far more likely than a life-permitting universe. The constants and quantities are not determined by the laws of nature. There's no reason or evidence to suggest that fine-tuning is necessary. How about chance? Did we just get really, 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 really lucky? No. The probabilities involved are so ridiculously remote as to put the fine-tuning well beyond the reach of chance. So, in an effort to keep this option alive, some have gone beyond empirical science and opted for a more speculative approach, known as the multiverse. They imagine a universe generator that cranks out such a vast number of universes that odds are life-permitting universes will eventually pop out. However, there's no scientific evidence for the existence of this multiverse. It cannot be detected, observed, measured, or proved. And the universe generator itself would require an enormous amount of fine-tuning. Furthermore, small patches of order are far more probable than big ones. So the most probable observable universe would be a small one inhabited by a single, simple observer. But what we actually observe is the very thing that we should least expect, a vast, spectacularly complex, highly ordered universe inhabited by billions of other observers. So even if the multiverse existed, which is a moot point, it wouldn't do anything to explain the fine-tuning. Given the implausibility of physical necessity or chance, the best explanation for why the universe is fine-tuned for life may very well be it was designed that way. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect monkeyed with physics and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. There is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge.
As you can see, I could expand this much more than it's there, but it was a nice summary. The universe is finely tuned, and therefore the why questions about why it's finely tuned or why it has the kind of properties that it does arise. And of course, the very best answer is that there is someone behind the universe. So the Christian position, the Jewish Christian position, is that the universe is not something from nothing, but something from someone, which makes an awful lot more sense, in fact. Alvin Plantinga, who's a well-known Christian philosopher, but respected in non-Christian circles, as indeed many of these people that were quoted in that particular clip are not Christians. They're not necessarily people who follow Jesus like I do. Alvin Plantinga, however, is a Christian and he's a respected philosopher in academic circles. He writes, "There is superficial conflict, but deep concord between science and theistic religion like Christianity. But only superficial concord and deep conflict between science and naturalism, which is the atheist position that all there is what you see, what you can touch, what you can touch, what you can taste, what you can see, all those kinds of things. And he argues that in some very fine philosophy books, which are not easy to read, because he's a serious philosopher, in fact. Now, the belief in God persists in the community, although it's on the back foot in many cases. It persists because research has been done to show, in fact, that it is part of being human that you like to attribute reason for why things exist. That's what you do. I mean, we know that as we look around this room that there are reasons for why and that these chairs exist. Somebody made them. Somebody designed the carpet. Somebody designed the colouring, the lighting. We are naturally attuned as human beings to having reasons for why, looking for reasons for why. And research has been done, psychological research has been done, and this particular researcher writes this in an article quoted by Richard Dawkins, who is no friend of Christianity. She writes, "Separate bodies of research suggest that young children have a broad tendency to reason about natural phenomena in terms of purpose and orientation towards intention-based accounts of the origin of natural entities. Are children intuitive theists disposed to view natural phenomena as resulting from a non-human design? By the time children are around 5 years of age, the description of them may have explanatory value and practical relevance." In other words, children at Sunday school have no trouble believing that behind the universe is a designer, a creator of some sort. What actually happens to people is that everyone starts like that, but people become disillusioned as they get older, or they reason themselves out of it. And many of the great scientists who are atheists today are people who have moved away from what is a normal, natural position that we all start with. We're born theists. We're not born atheists. You become an atheist. That's what happens, in fact. And there's research to show that. That, in fact, as we grow older, some people diverge and other people continue and say, there must be more, and start to study and start to learn and start to understand and realise that from their childhood, what they believed in simply actually has some real rational basis behind it. That's where we are, and that's certainly where I am today. Paul Davies, who's a good man, an agnostic, he's not a Christian, but he writes this: "On the face of it, the universe does look like it has been designed by an intelligent creator expressly for the purpose of spawning intelligent beings. Like the porridge in the tale of Goldilocks and the three bears, the universe seems to be just right for life in many intriguing ways. No scientific explanation for the universe can be deemed complete unless it accounts for this apparent this appearance of judicious design." That's a challenge. He's an agnostic. He doesn't believe that necessarily God is a good answer. He doesn't believe that. But it is a good answer. It is a rational answer, even though other people may have alternative explanations. The truth is that the existence of God, who lies behind the universe and is a creation of someone, is a very good explanation as such. Albert Einstein, again, not a man known for his Christianity or his Judaism, although he went to a Christian school and though he was part of a Jewish family, nevertheless writes this: "For the scientific message can teach us nothing else beyond how facts are related to and conditioned by each other. Knowledge of what is does not open the door directly to what should be. That's actually a very profound statement. The difference between is and ought. We have a universe which is, but why ought it to be this way? Well, those are the questions that are the why questions, which are there as part of being human, and which I think in the world of science also needs to be asked. And what I like about the clip that I had earlier was at least people were acknowledging that there were interesting questions that lay behind it. And those are the ones that I'm very interested in myself and want to bring to you. But science can only be created by those who are thoroughly imbued with the aspiration towards truth and understanding. Science is about truth and understanding. This source of feeling, however, springs from the sphere of religion. I cannot conceive of a genuine scientist without that profound faith in truth, for instance, and understanding. The situation may be expressed by an image. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. That's a very famous quote. He gave this lecture to Princeton University in 1935, and it's been recorded in a book which I have at home. So it's very interesting to see that there are questions which are more holistic than simply measurement and getting answers to measurement. There are questions that are beyond that, which are also part of being human, which are also part of what a science person who's interested in the why of things would also ask, and that's exactly where I was and am. Science does not even have enough reason for its own existence. That's a hard saying for many scientists, in fact. But there isn't good enough. The only reason that you can do science is because the universe is ordered, that it has laws, that it has principles, that it has something that is already there. We discover the universe. We don't create the universe in science. We discover it. And so it does not have enough reason for its own existence. In fact, its existence is something that goes back to the why questions. Now, how can we know this God? Okay, I think I've made a reasonable case that there's something and someone behind the universe, but how can we know this someone? The problem is actually one of extrapolation. Extrapolation is a big word, but what that simply means is I have a few data points, and you might be able to see the little triangles, which are the data points at the beginning of this graph. And I need to know how it all fits together. Is it a straight line or is it bent up? And this is called extrapolation. How do you go? You've only got a few experimental points. How do you go out there to understand where that all fits together? That's called extrapolation. Now, the answer to that question, in fact, let me just move this thing on because there's a few there. Physical nature and the quest for understanding our humanity may reasonably point to God, but it is incomplete. It doesn't have answers to the why questions, and it doesn't have the data points further up the scale. And that's why I want to suggest that input by God, from God, by revelation, is needed to complete our knowledge of who God is. That is actually remarkable. If creation is from someone rather than from something, but someone, that someone has the possibility to communicate. A person can love, a person can have morality, a person can communicate. And that is exactly why we have the Bible. This God who I'm arguing is actually behind all the science questions. This God, in fact, has communicated, has revealed, that's why we talk about revelation, has revealed something about himself and has revealed something about the relationship between us and him. So this is now coming from the other side. We want to have those data points. Well, those data points that we're missing now come by revelation. That's the point I'm trying to make. Information from biblical sources. The Hebrew scripture informs the why questions we want answers to. God reveals himself in these writings recorded in scripture as creator, designer, artist, a person, love, communication, and moral expectations. All make sense now. Without that, it wouldn't make any sense. And that is, I'm offering, that is the reasonable points that are missing from what we can see in nature to ask the real why questions, and we're looking for answers to those particular why questions. Knowledge from scripture complements what we can know from measurement, in fact. So often people are critical of the book of Genesis, but they immediately go to the book of Genesis and say, oh yeah, but you know, that contradicts science. It's not as simple as that. The book of Genesis was written, which is a part of the Bible, was written nearly 3,000 years ago, in fact. And I don't go looking for my science there, but I'm amazed how well it resonates with modern science. Of all the ancient literature which is out there, Babylonian, Mesopotamian, Egyptian, Canaanite, of all the ancient literature which is out there, the science in Genesis, the revelation in Genesis, is the closest to modern science of any of the alternative things out there. It still has something to say, but it resonates. It's not science. It resonates, nevertheless, with what science says, and that's all I wanted to argue. Genesis is not a detailed science textbook, and I don't go looking there for my science, but this is true. Of all the ancient texts, the biblical revelation in Genesis broadly resonates with modern science. Let's look at some of these things. The universe had a beginning. We, in physics, call it the Big Bang. It's not an explosion, by the way, but I've digressed too much to explain exactly what it is. God created. What the modern view of the beginning of the universe is a very sudden expansion and then a slow expansion of space and time. In fact, we call it the inflationary universe. The universe changed in volume by 10 to the power of 76 and 10 to the minus 31 of a second. For those of you who understand big numbers and small numbers, you'll understand it was, and God created. It's very consistent with that statement. It started in chaos. Physicists might call it quantum gravity. There is progress in creation. We, in science, might call that evolution. When we look back over time, we see the universe has developed. We would call that evolution, but there's progress. It's not a Darwinian idea. It's actually in the Bible, the idea that there's progress in creation. It's already there. The separation of land and sea, we might call that in science plate tectonics. Humankind is created last. That's completely consistent with the fossil record coming out of science. Yeah, it's not a straight Adam and Eve, as we read in chapters 2 and 3, but certainly humankind, anatomically modern human like you and I, have a beginning. In fact, about 150,000 to 170,000 years ago, in fact. There is an original Adam and Eve. Now, it may not be the Adam and Eve of chapters 2 and 3, but the idea of a beginning can be traced back genetically. So you, as men, give your Y chromosome. If you have sons, your Y chromosome is given to your sons and to their sons. And so it's actually possible to do some tracing back to see that there was an original Adam. And likewise, you can go backwards through mitochondrial DNA, through women. You can go back and you can work out that there were as an original Eve as well. Now, all I'm saying is that it resonates. I'm not trying to make it my science. All I'm trying to say is that there's a real resonance, because this ancient document Nevertheless, which has structure and has a lot of other, pushes a lot of other ideas and interests as well. Yet nevertheless, there is a certain resonance between it and modern science. There's something special about being human. Observationally true, art, culture, creativity, language, abstract thought and transcendence, all these things are part of being human. We are different. Do you realise that the apes in Taronga Zoo at the moment are not sitting there having just had breakfast with a cup of tea and philosophising and thinking about these kind of issues? They're not. And there's only 1% difference in their genetic material to ourselves. There is something unique, something special about being human as well. And again, the Bible answers that question by saying that we are created in the image and likeness of God. So not only do we have an answer to why the universe is the way that it is, it also have an answer from the scripture as to why we are unique, why there's something special about being human. Well, so far I've argued for the existence of God. I've argued that the Jewish Christian scriptures give us answers. I've argued that this God is a person, has morality, can communicate and do all those kind of things. But the question now is, why take the living God revealed in the Bible over other gods? There are many religions in the world. So why the Jewish Christian position? Is it because we've grown up here? No, it's more than that. Well, that may be the case, you know, for most of us, that's how we were introduced to it. But the truth is that as you investigate it, there is something unique about the Jewish Christian revelation. Aren't all religions essentially the same? Aren't we all travelling the mountain path to God, which is exactly the kind of thing that the ABC would like you to believe? That all of us are ultimately just travelling different paths to the same position, to our understanding of God as such. And why the uniqueness? Well, what is interesting is that the unique difference is that the Bible reveals that God has come to us in space and time in the person of Jesus. Now, that's interesting. So we're not all just travelling on the mountains together. In the Jewish Christian understanding, God has come to us in the fullness of the person of Jesus. Wow, that's a big leap. That's a big thing. That obviously I need to justify that an awful lot more, and I don't have a lot of time. But one of the fascinating things is that it certainly inspired me to become a Christian, i.e. a follower of Jesus, is that when I read the New Testament documents, I realized that this man, Jesus, was somebody rather remarkable. And that he proved who he said he was. He said he was, he and the Father were one, and he showed that in the various things that he did. And I took notice of that and chose to follow this man as part of being human as well. Jesus is a space-time projection of God. Paul, a Jewish follower of the Hebrew God, and an enemy of Jesus, in fact, at one stage, initially he was, writes this with conviction, and he writes this to a church in Colossae. The Son, i.e. Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him. That's amazing. And through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Now, of course, you are just sort of at the beginning of trying to understand this, there's a lot that needs to be unpacked there. But the reality is, in fact, that this Jesus, in him is the fullness of God. It's called the incarnation, technically. God has come to us. This makes Christianity, Jewish Christian revelation, absolutely unique. It's not us trying to climb our way up to the top of the mountain. It is Jesus who represents God fully who's come to us. God is worth a second look. We've forgotten that in our society. Our society, the Western society, has been built, not always well, but has been built on understanding the scripture and its impact. And I would want to argue that our great problem today is that God needs to be looked at once again. Jesus, God incarnate, is worth a second look. And finally, and yes, a scientist and a rational person can take Christianity seriously. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. There are a number of things that maybe that some people would like to ask you.
Sure.
In your wisdom and in your zeal for the gospel. Questions. Are there any questions which anyone would like to put forward to Frank? And he'll do his best to ask. We have one written question which I think you've got a copy of, Frank.
Have I? I haven't looked at it, I'm sorry.
Haven't you? All right. Okay. Well, I'll grab that later. Well, if you'd like to put your hand up.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out that I have a written question there. Which
sure. I'm sorry I haven't looked at it.
No, that's all right. One of the things that's kept me very grounded in my faith and grown is what I discovered or what's revealed to me through science. Lots of times, like you have shown here, great men of science have reflected on their lives and where God has fit in their lives. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading one of Stephen Hawking's final books. Mm-hmm. He said that it is most likely that the science came from a creator. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately for him, he hadn't found it a personal creator. Mm-hmm. I think that's very honest.
Mm. Well, we'll take that as a statement, as they say on Q&A. Is there any questions? Yes. Climate change.
Well, it's left field, but nevertheless, what do I think about it? I think climate change is real. The question really is, how much are we contributing to it? That's the real question. The question isn't about climate change. I think we're seeing climate change. The question is, to what extent is number one? Number two, can we do something about it? Can we really do something about it? Or are we committed to the kind of projection, the pathway that is set before us because of the kind of lifestyle that we've chosen and the things that we want? But as a Christian, I would want to say, I don't have simple answers to either of those two questions. To what extent do we contribute to it? To what extent can we fix it? I think it's real. But I do believe that we need to be good stewards and responsible. And so as a Christian, I'm a fiend for recycling and doing it properly. I believe that, you know, care and stewardship of the planet has been too long forgotten, even in the Christian community. And I would want to say very strongly that, you know, we need to behave responsibly. I might not be able to fix climate change. I might not understand just to what extent modern industrialization has actually contributed to it, as it must have contributed something. The reality, however, is that I am responsible as a child of God, fully human, who's commissioned me to rule and subdue, not to rape. And therefore, I do believe seriously in proper waste management, in proper recycling, in recovering plastics if we can recover them, and all those kinds of things. So that would be my kind of comprehensive answers. I can't give you the exact detail of how much and how whether we can be successful, but I know China, climate change is happening all around us. That's pretty obvious, I think, even anecdotally. And I do think responsibility is something the Christian Church should be promoting to all its followers.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you. But we, as Christians, we look forward to the new heaven and the new earth at the return of Jesus. Yes?
I just wonder if you could expand a little bit. You mentioned the progress in creation versus evolution, and right. That's an argument that we often come up against.
Yeah.
Well,
one of the interesting things about Genesis, taken as a creation account and not so much as science, one of the things is to see that time is involved. The existence of time is rather important in Genesis. As you see the days of creation, you see things changing or evolving. That's what the word means. Changing. We see new things. We see differences, we see differentiation, we see those kinds of things, and we see all of that happening in time. And that is exactly what we measure. As we look back over the history, whether we're looking at the fossil record, whether we're looking at geological evidence, whatever evidence we might measure, time is involved. And to that extent, there's a synergy between this simple creation account, which resonates with those things that we measure. And it's then that extent, time is involved. And time is involved in all of us. We are who we are now at this moment of history because there's been a flow of time. The processes in your body are an important part of who you are, and that involves time.
Good, thank you. You had a question.
During your working life, yeah. Scientist.
Yep. Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that there were quite a few on my staff who actually were believers. And so I had that in common. There was only one man who was an out-and-out atheist. A chemist, he was. And so one day I said to him, how about we have a debate in front of the students? You take up your atheist position and I'll take up my Christian position. And he wouldn't be in it. So I have spoken at universities. I have obviously argued for the rationality of a Christian faith. And I've spoken in an atheist forum. I actually spoke to the Atheist Society at Sydney University. I was invited to speak to them. So yes, I've had the opportunity directly in contact with colleagues. I've had some fun with them. I once had a woman biochemist who came up to me and who showed me DNA completely unraveled. And she said, "Isn't this wonderful?" I said, "It's terrific." And it all came together by chance, didn't it? And she dug me in the ribs and she said, "Ah, you know." So yes and no. It's not a every day where you can just sort of talk with people. You take the opportunity. I've had nothing but respect. I was head of the Vision of Science at one stage. I've had nothing but respect from my colleagues. And the only colleague who wanted to really tackle me was too chicken to do it in front of the public. So.
Well, that's what I was getting at. When you're sitting around having morning tea,
yep.
What
yep.
makes you tick, right?
Yeah, then I would answer the question. Of course I would. And in fact, you know, I've had lots of opportunities to speak in different forums invited. But, you know yourself in your own workplace or whatever you did, it's People are apathetic or they're disinterested, and they don't necessarily ask those questions in terms of what makes you tick and why do you believe what you do. Most people, that's a no-go zone. You just don't go there. And in fact, you've all found that in your workplaces, that it's not so straightforward to begin a conversation. And in fact, perhaps the real thrust of what we should be doing as Christians in this community is to ask why questions, really. You know, not to give answers all the time, but to be asking the questions, the hard questions. So you don't believe in God. Well, all right, but how do you make sense of the world that you actually live in? That's a very good opening question. You don't believe in God. Well, how do you get your values, significance and meaning in life then? You know, how does that work? I mean, these are the kind of, it's perhaps better to start with questions these days than to give the answers that we all know. We can all quote John 3:16, but most people aren't interested. But most people would be on the back foot if you ask them serious, nice questions like, well, what does it all mean to you then?
Good, thanks, Frank. Has anyone else got a question? Up at the back, Matthew?
I guess one of the questions that keeps sort of coming back to me is, we hear quite often the discovery of a fossil, some sort of evidence in the scientific world that the universe seems to have been existing so much longer than what, say, the biblical account.
Sure. Okay, firstly, let's start with Genesis. One of the things, and there's a very helpful article on the web, if you want to read it, by John Dixon. The first thing you've got to recognise is that Genesis is not a science account, first and foremost. It resonates with science, but it has structure, and it has been structured in a very profound way. For instance, let me give you some examples. If I had more time, I would go into much more detail. The first sentence in Genesis chapter 1 has exactly 7 Hebrew words in it. Is that an accident? The second sentence has exactly 14 Hebrew words in it. The number 7, which is a sign of completeness in Jewish thinking, appears right throughout the text. 7 days. The word earth appears 21 times. The word heaven appears 21 times. You have this multiple of 7 right throughout the text as well. What this tells me is that it isn't simply a science account. It might resonate with modern science, but it actually has a profound literary structure as well. So the first thing I would want to say is that in understanding Genesis, don't simply look at it through modern eyes only and say, well, it must be fit in with my science exactly, or I can't take it seriously. You know, so if it isn't exactly 7 days, then it's a problem. No, you must understand that Genesis does more than simply resonate with factual information. It actually has substructure. It is an opening, it is beginnings. That's what Genesis means. It's a beginning text. And if you allow that substructure, if you allow its literary form, then you don't get hung up on the exact one-to-one correspondence. There is correspondence. That's what I've argued earlier. There is correspondence. It resonates. That's the word I'm using deliberately. There is correspondence. But if you deny its literary form and substructure, then you are you're pushing it in one direction where you don't really need to go. And so in terms of finding the balance there, that is part of the problem, I think, so often in the Christian church as well. That in fact, Genesis is a profound bit of literature and apologetic to its own culture. Remember, when it was written in about 1450 BC by Moses and certainly by Moses. If you look at the Mesopotamian, if you look at the Babylonian, and you look at their creation accounts and their pantheon of gods and the gods copulating with one another and causing humans to arise and all this very complex creation account, Genesis 1 is nothing like that. It simply states there is a God, and as a consequence, he has made all these things. There is no sun god. There's no worship of sun. There's no worship of moon. It is God who does and creates the moon and the stars and the sun. And so we see literary substructure which surrounds resonance with things that we know that we can measure. And for me, that's the holistic answer there. For many people, that's unsatisfactory, or it doesn't fulfill. You know, they want to have exact detail. But I think that is trying to make a photograph out of a picture. You know, if you stand in front of an impressionist painting of some sort, if you stand too close to it, you can ask all sorts of, because impressionist painting is using strokes like this. You stand close to it, then you can ask all sorts of funny questions, like, why that never looked like that. I don't think that looks like that at all, you know. But you go to a good art museum and look at some, impressionist paintings of various, the masters, and don't stand like that in front of it. Stand back a few feet. What do you see? Amazing beauty out of what are actually just strokes. And I think this tells you the difference between resolution. It's called resolution scientifically. If you have very high resolution, you have very small pixels, you end up with a photograph. If you don't have high resolution, then you don't have a photo, you end up with a picture. But a painter does more than want to give you a picture. A painter is also asking you the question, how does it make you feel? Is also evocative, is attempting to drag you into a story, into an impression, into something about reality. It's a lot more than simply trying to give you a photograph. And I think that's part of our problem. We're used to wanting photographs all the time when we have a picture of reality, to be sure, because even impressionist paintings have trees standing up straight, have water lying down the bottom there, have clouds up there. Even in their impressionism, that's true, and that's true of Genesis. But at the same time, it's a picture. You know, your young daughter or young son, when they were young, understood in, say, chapters 2 and 3, when God says to Adam, don't do that, that when he does do that, he gets into trouble. Well, you don't need to be a genius to work out when you're a kid that if mum and dad says, don't do that, and you do that, you end up in trouble. And so there's a lot more going on in Genesis than simply, you know, fact, 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 fact. It is a resonance, a unique bit of literature, and something that reveals someone to us.
Thank you, Frank. We're now seriously out of time.